I mean, pondering what it's like to be a transformed, God-centered person in the world around us, you know, makes us want to get out our notebooks and start making lists and schedules and outlines. And we're drawn to the idea of deep down godly dedication and commitment. You know, we admire and look up to those who are pursuing such God-centered lives. But it doesn't mean we're actually become more courageous, consistent, or useful ourselves. We're still more likely to follow the world's zig instead of the kingdom's zag. And you know what? That's just not really a transformed life. So how do we live such transformed lives? How do we become God-centered, God-honoring people in what is really a self-centered society? We follow Christ's example. You look to the cross. You have to grasp the kingdom and the nature of the kingdom and the kingdom principles. You have to grasp how the kingdom works. When you get that, when you begin to believe that what Christ's kingdom has to offer is better than the world's, when you grasp what true greatness is, what it means to have glory, then you'll start to live a transformed life. A God-centered life in a self-centered world. And Mark 10, verse 32 to 45, begins to show us what it means to live in light of the cross, and what true greatness, true glory is. Firstly, verse 32 to 35, death and resurrection. Death and resurrection. Have you ever watched one of those films where someone is going to be executed? You know, something like Green Mile or Prison Break. Now, when I watch such a film, it gets me thinking, how must it feel to know that at precisely that time tomorrow, you're going to die? You know, you pretty much know to the minute when you will die, and it will be the end. And I'm trying to imagine what it must be like to eat your last meal, or say goodbye to your family, or to walk that stretch from your cell to the chamber, and to be strapped down, and to hear the switch, meaning that within seconds, that's it. I can't imagine how you would feel, especially if you were innocent. But Jesus knew exactly how it felt. See, Jesus, verse 32, is on his way up to Jerusalem. This is the last journey of Jesus' ministry. Final destination is in full view. The hour for which he ultimately came now approaches. He's already made it clear to his disciples in chapter 8, verse 31, that the Messiah must die in Jerusalem. He's repeated it in chapter 9, verse 31. He'll spell it out again in chapter 10, verse 45. He's come to give his life as a ransom for many. And yet the long journey to Jerusalem and the cross will apparently be a lonely one for the Saviour. He's making it without the full understanding and support of his disciples. They're astonished by what he's doing, verse 32. Some are afraid. And the truth is, as we'll see, they continue to be blinded by selfish ambition. And he must continue to teach and instruct and comfort them. And yet, however grieved his heart must surely be at this moment, we see him walking ahead, verse 32. No one's prodding him. No one's forcing him on. He's leading the way. And the one leading the way is the only one in this group of travellers who is aware of what indescribable anguish awaits him there. And just pause and picture that in your mind. Behold this lone figure out in front, fully aware of what awaits him in Jerusalem. And you see him steadfast in heart, determined, setting the pace for his disciples, striding purposefully forward. Where? To Jerusalem. Why? To die. He will not be deterred. He's full of resolve as he keeps his appointment made in eternity past. Relentlessly, he proceeds to a place where he's going to be betrayed and arrested, verse 33, where he's going to be accused and condemned, where he'd be mocked and spat upon and flogged and ultimately executed. And there is no hesitation. There's no reluctance in his steps. Though unimaginable suffering is before him, he's walking ahead, he's leading the way. It's the moment he's come for. It's the moment which had been foretold in Isaiah 50 and Isaiah 53 and elsewhere in the Old Testament. It's this moment that has shaped his ministry. It's this moment that will transform lives both now and for eternity. It's his death and resurrection that will give shape to our lives and purpose. When it comes to humility and suffering, Jesus is leading the way. And like the disciples, we're to follow. Jesus is setting the pattern, the course, the agenda. He's outlining the kingdom principles. It's death and resurrection, it's suffering, then glory. But the disciples don't get it. And the contrast is apparent. See verses 35 to 41. Suffering, then glory. Suffering, then glory. See, previously when Jesus had been speaking about his betrayal and death in chapter 9, verse 31, speaking about humble suffering, the disciples start talking about greatness. So chapter 9, verse 34, in response to Jesus' question about what they have been arguing over, we read they kept quiet because on the way they had argued about who was the greatest, which of them was the greatest, the most important, the best. These men who were receiving intense training from Jesus, the ultimate example of humility and servanthood, were embroiled in a full-scale dispute about their relative superiority to each other. And Jesus, knowing their hearts, instructs them, chapter 9, verse 35. He says, if anyone wants to be first, he must be the very last and the servant of all. See, Jesus is radically redefining greatness and glory. But his point apparently does not sink in. And so in chapter 10, verse 35, we find the brothers, James and John, approaching the Saviour, apart from their fellow disciples, in apparent agreement with each other about their own greatness. I mean, these two brothers bring to Jesus a special request. Apparently, James and John think that Jesus shares their lofty assessment of themselves because there's absolutely no lack of confidence evident in what they ask. Teacher, they say to him, we want you to do for us whatever we ask. Jesus asks them, well, what do you want me to do for you? They answer, let one of us sit at your right and the other at your left in your glory. Now, they recognize Jesus is the Messiah, that Jesus is God's anointed king. They see that. They know Jesus is on the way to Jerusalem, but in their mind, they're thinking, presumably recording some of the Old Testament, where a procession to Jerusalem resulted in glory. That's what they're imagining. That when the Messiah arrives in Jerusalem, he's going to establish his kingdom militarily and politically. That his glory will be established at that moment. And in Jewish custom, the place of highest honor was at the center of the company, followed by the right and left hands, respectively. I mean, the brothers hope to honor Jesus. He's at the center whilst honoring themselves. They undoubtedly assume such a prominent place for them is appropriate in light of their obvious superiority. You know, let's settle this greatness issue now, Jesus, they seem to be saying. You know, who's the greatest? We're the greatest. And Master, we want you to acknowledge this fact by letting us sit at your right and your left. I mean, there's nothing subtle about their request. They're not asking for faith to endure his suffering. They're not asking for the privilege of supporting him in and through his suffering. They want to be famous, pure and simple. They want glory, and they want it now. I mean, if Big Brother Israel had existed, they would have been on it. They'd have been the first two to sign up to Big Brother and live in a house in Israel and have people watch them because they wanted to be famous. What a terrible show. We won't go there. But you get the idea? And don't think for a moment that the other disciples are any better, that they had stopped wishing for such glory and such greatness. Have a look, verse 41. When they hear, they're indignant with James and John. angry that they should request such a thing, angry that James and John should think themselves greater than them. Can you see yourself in the story? It's easy to sit here, isn't it, and be amazed and indignant that the disciples would behave this way, but if you're like me, you compare yourselves to others. You look for opportunities to claim greater importance than them all the time, looking for the glory now, wanting to be the one that is known, whose name is recognized, whose name is well thought of. I mean, we like people to know us. We like to feel important. We want glory now. We think it's ours for the asking. We're just like James and John, self-centered glory hunters. I go to conferences and you meet up with people and they just ask the questions. They want to know, are you a conference speaker? Have you written books? You know, how big is the church? It's all status. They want you to know the glory. You want to be famous. We all have it in our industries, our works, our homes. We want glory now. And we think it's ours for the asking. We're self-centered glory hunters. But Jesus turns such thinking upside down. See, James and John want to share in his glory, but will they share in his suffering? They don't get it. They don't see that Jesus' glory will come through his suffering, that it's death, then resurrection. That's what he's been telling them. It's what he said in verse 34. It's suffering, then glory. That's the pattern. They cannot just ask for the glory. That's not the way it works in the kingdom. It's suffering, then glory. And so verse 38a is a rebuke. You don't know what you're asking. And verse 38b in the Greek is a question expecting the answer, no. Because the cup is a picture of God's judgment. So you read Isaiah 51, verse 22, or Psalm 60, verse 3, and you read of a cup, a goblet of God's wrath at man's sin. And the picture of baptism is similar here. It's the idea of being overwhelmed by water in the Old Testament is an image of God's wrath. You have to think of the flood or the Red Sea. So Jesus here is clearly talking about his unique wrath-bearing death and subsequent resurrection, which he's already spoken of in chapter 9, verse 31, and chapter 10, verse 33 and 34. And James and John, instead of answering, no, we can't, confidently say, yes, we can. We can share in your suffering, Jesus. And it's a big boast. It's a big boast. It's like when my children, and I say to my children, because I'm this kind of dad, I say, who's the strongest? And they go, we are. And I pin them down. And I say, who's the strongest? In love, not hard. Pin them down. And I say, who's the strongest? They say, we are. And I pin them down a bit more and I tickle them a little bit harder. And I say, who's the strongest? They say, you are. And I say, yeah, I am. I am the alpha male. I am the strongest. They get it. But it's a boast thing for them. We're the strongest. James and John are doing a similar thing here. Yeah, we can. But Jesus says, you do not know what you're saying. Because you do not appreciate the price of freeing them from the strong man in chapter 3. Or that a man cannot buy his own life back, chapter 10, verse 45. Or that a man cannot save himself, chapter 10, verse 27. They think glory is to be had for the asking. That it kind of comes without works. That it comes without an infinitely costly work of God. But there is no glory without suffering, without Christ suffering. In the kingdom, it's suffering first, then glory. The glory God gives comes through suffering. It's striking that Jesus does not deny them glory. See verse 40? It's just not for him to grant. He doesn't say there is no glory. He just says it's not for him to grant. These places belong to those for whom they've been prepared. In other words, there is a glory to come. And God will grant glory to those whom he decrees, but first their suffering. So verse 39, you will drink the cup I drink and be baptized with the baptism I am baptized with. Now Jesus cannot be contradicting himself. You know, where he's asked in verse 38, asking the question, can you drink? And the implied answer is no. He's not contradicting himself here, because he's just been teaching and making clear that his death on the cross is unique. They can't do what he will do. But you see, the cross is something in which believers must share. It's not that we have to endure the cross for ourselves, that we bear the punishment and the sacrifice and we drink the wrath of God. We can't. But such is our identity with Christ and his with us, that the Bible speaks of us as being crucified with him. So Paul writes, Galatians 2:20, I've been crucified with Christ. On the cross, Jesus identifies with sinners. He drinks the unique cup of God's wrath so that we didn't have to. And in faith, I share in that by trusting in his death. And the way the believer then in turn identifies with this crucified Christ and drinks his cup and is baptized with the baptism he is baptized with is by following unashamedly the pattern of the cross. See, Jesus has taught, isn't he? Chapter 8, verse 34. We are to take up our crosses and follow him. The way of the kingdom is not about glory now. It's about laying down our lives for the sake of following Jesus. And in that sense, James and John will drink the cup and be baptized, and they will suffer for Christ, and they will follow his example in the kingdom. Because in the kingdom, it's suffering, then glory. The world wants glory now. For the world, it's all about me. How great I am, how good I look. In the kingdom, it's all about taking up your cross. It's all about him. It's about laying down our lives for him and seeking to follow Christ's example. It's suffering now and glory later. But it's not my glory I seek. No, we sit at the right and the left. It is Christ who will be glorified. It's him who has won God's glory. It is him who is deserving of God's glory. It is him who died and bore our wrath. It's him who bore God's wrath, sorry, and drank the cup of God's wrath. It's his glory. And as one in him, I share his glory. And we will bathe, as it were, in his reflected glory. See, a transformed, God-centered life will involve suffering. Because it will mean drinking the cup and being baptized with Jesus' baptism. Because it will mean taking up my cross. It will mean laying down my life. It will mean not seeking my glory or my fame, but seeking to follow my Lord. And what will that look like? Service. Service. See verse 42 to 45? Serving is greatness. Serving is greatness. Jesus calls all the disciples to him, verse 42. And he lovingly, patiently teaches them once more. And he reminds them first of what they've all observed during the long years of Roman occupation. Verse 42, you know that those who are regarded as rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their high officials exercise authority over them. And then Jesus sets the contrast down, but it shall not be so among you. Verse 43, whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant, and whoever wants to be first must be slave of all. And note the word must. Must points us to something that is required, something that is indispensable. You want to be great, says Jesus. You want glory, says Jesus. You want to drink my cup? Here's what has to happen. What is required is that you take up your cross, you lay down your life, and you become a servant to others. It means nothing less than becoming the slave of everyone. You lay down your life and you serve. And the reason that we do is because, verse 45, even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many. Now, verse 45 is not just implying we serve because we're following Jesus' example. We do. No, verse 45 is the very reason that we will serve. It's Jesus' death that will so transform us from our selfish desire for glory, from our self-centered, glory-hunting boasts, to be those who desire to lay down our lives and serve others. because he sets us free from our bondage to sin. He did what's impossible for us, chapter 10, verse 27, to do. He paid our ransom. Now, ransom is a familiar image in the Jewish and Roman and Greek cultures. It was the price paid to liberate a slave, a prisoner of war, or a condemned person. And Jesus paid the price to free us from our captivity to sin. See, to hear Jesus speak the word ransom and understand it rightly is to see our own serious and sorry state. To see that actually we're captives to sin. We're enslaved to it, Ephesians 2 verse 1. And it's this captivity to sin that means Jesus must die as a ransom for many. The price the ransom requires is the life of God's only Son. You see, it's humanly impossible for the disciples to free themselves from their selfish pursuit of self-exaltation and for glory. Just as it's impossible for us to free ourselves from the very same sins, from wanting to be self-centered and seeking our glory. But God accomplished that which is humanly impossible. He pays the price for our freedom, and the price is the sinless Son of God's sacrifice on the cross. And his death so transforms us that those who trust in him will willingly take up their cross, lay down their lives, and seek to be a servant and a slave to all. See, what happens to James and John? They were ransomed, they were forgiven, and they were transformed. They were transformed from self-confident men into humble servants who would live to serve others with the gospel of the glory of God, and they would suffer. James was the first of the apostles to be martyred. So we read Acts 12, verse 1 and 2. About that time, Herod the king arrested some who belonged to the church, intending to persecute them. He had James, the brother of John, put to death with the sword. James suffered. He laid down his life. He served. Why? Because his Saviour had ransomed him and set him free from the sin that so captivated him, from self-centred glory hunting, and so transformed him to lay down his life, to take up his cross. Or what about John? Well, John was apparently the last of all the apostles to die, but he suffered persecution. He was banished to the island of Patmos, and it's obvious from his letters that he understood his Saviour's teaching. So we read 1 John 3:16. By this, he says, we know love, that Christ laid down his life for us, and we ought to lay down our lives for the brothers. John suffered. He laid down his life. He served. Why? Because his Saviour had ransomed him and set him free from the sin that captivated him, from self-centred, glory-hunting boasts, and so transformed him. And what will transform us from self-centeredness to God-centeredness? Trust in Jesus to ransom us. Trust in Jesus to pay the price by his death to set us free. And having been ransomed, it should so move us that we desire nothing more to serve others and to lay down our lives for others, following his example and drinking his cup, knowing that it is suffering first, then glory. Knowing that it is serving that is true greatness in the kingdom. And if you grasp that, and you keep meditating on that, and you keep asking the Lord to apply that to your heart, and you keep preaching the gospel to your heart so you're so moved by that each day, you'll live a transformed life. We'll be those who serve others for the glory of God in a self-centered society. See, when you grasp that the ransom's been paid, you'll be transformed. So you'll be like the teenage son who honors his parents and cares for his younger siblings, including his brother with autism. It'll be the single woman with an infectious laugh who cheerfully serves numerous families in her church. It will be the successful businessman who volunteers each Sunday to wash up after coffee and clean the toilets. It'll be the mum who works tirelessly in her home to care for her husband and her small children. It'll be the single older man who lives a simple life so that he could give generously to families in need and further God's mission abroad. It'll be the father who left the job he loved and all that was familiar to move his family across the country to a stronger local church. It'll be the older couple in their 80s who, despite severe health issues, pour out their hearts and lives into the small group that he leads. It'll be the couple who sacrificially open up their home to the homeless and those in need. It'll be the couple in their 50s who decide to retire early and go and serve in a local church on a needy housing estate rather than retiring to the sea to be near their family. How will you lay down your life? How will you lay down your life and serve? You'll only be moved to serve others if we've been set free by his ransom, by his death. If he has set us free from our self-centeredness. And having been set free, we seek to remain in him and abide in him. If we've seen that it's suffering now and glory later. If we've seen that true greatness is serving the King. How will you lay down your life and serve?